Why don't we try to get started? My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you to this program to look at efforts to engage patients in managing their own care and the potential of those efforts to both improve the quality of care and help get a handle on rising health care costs. That welcome is extended on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins and our board of directors. We're very pleased to have all of you with us today. There was a statement that President Obama made a couple of days ago who said, among other things on Wednesday, that everything there is to say about health care has been said. Is he trying to put us out of business? What is this? I don't believe it. I don't believe it's going to be true even if a comprehensive bill is passed. It certainly won't be true if it isn't. John Rother, my co-moderator today, was describing the topic that we're engaging today as kind of an evergreen topic. That is, this is an opportunity and a challenge no matter what happens in the larger reform debate. We want to know if consumer behavior can be changed enough from the current mostly passive role to move us toward this high-value intervention that is the goal and away from unnecessary utilization. We hope to take a look at a lot of interventions for pursuing this goal, everything from shared decision-making and value-based benefit design to a series of tools that make those interventions possible, like electronic health records. Now, whatever happens, the importance of this patient engagement issue is going to be worthy of attention. As I implied, our co-sponsor in this briefing is AARP, which represents millions of Americans over the age of 50. conflict of interest, and which has definite views on this issue. Sharing moderator duties with me today is the personification of interlocking directorates in this context. John Rother, who's both AARP's Executive Vice President of Policy and Strategy and a member of the Alliance for Health Reform Board of Directors. And we've asked him to give us not only a welcome, but a brief introduction to this topic. John, thanks for being with us.
And thank you, Ed. Thank you for your sponsorship here and for your leadership throughout the years. We embark on a very important couple of weeks. But patient engagement is an important issue, and it's a key, I think, to getting better value in healthcare and moving healthcare in the direction of more effectiveness and more appropriateness. The IOM has identified patient-centered care as a key element of healthcare quality. MedPAC was debating the issue of consumer engagement through shared decision-making models at its meeting yesterday here in Washington. So it's certainly been an important topic for many years. Our panel today is, I think, a terrific panel, and the theme here is how to strengthen consumer engagement and how to make more effective the role that patients and consumers play in managing their own health. This has not been a high-profile issue in the health reform debate, but when we get down to the ground level, when the rubber meets the road, I think it's very high impact, and it's difficult. A lot of challenges in this, because we're talking about changing behavior. So Judy Hibbard, one of our speakers today, tells us that engaged consumers do have to take on new roles and behaviors. And when they do, they choose higher performing providers. They select cost-effective, evidence-based treatments, collaborate with providers, and are vigilant partners in preventing errors and in promoting better health practices. So there's a lot of potential here. but there's also a lot of challenges. So today we're hoping the panel will help us look at promising models for activating consumers. We're hoping that the panel will address changes in the healthcare system that are needed to support greater consumer participation. We're hoping to see ways that health reform legislation might impact the adoption of some of these promising models and systems reforms. And we're hoping that the panel will also talk about the potential for patient engagement to help hold down the growth and healthcare costs by targeting waste and undertreatment, overtreatment, and inappropriate care. So very happy to share the duties with Ed today. And Ed, back to you.
Thank you, John. A couple of logistical items that those of you who have been to our briefings before will have heard before, at least most of them. You'll find a lot of material in your packets, background information, speaker bios, much more extensive than the introductions that we'll give our distinguished panelists today, including their PowerPoint presentations. By the way, next time we do a briefing, which is not yet scheduled, we're gonna respond to some substantial comments on your behalf and give you hard copies of the presentations and some of the other pieces that you need to follow along, but put all of the background information on a website that you will have access to in advance and can print out what you want and not what you don't want. So you'll have advance access to that list of things. That's what you said you preferred, so we're going to try it and see how it works, save some trees and save you some trouble of schlepping paper you don't want. You'll be able to view a webcast of this briefing tomorrow on KFF.org, thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation. You can also find the background materials in your packets on that website and on the Alliance website, allhealth.org. There'll be a transcript available a few days from now that a lot of people find useful. And let me just remind you that we have some microphones once the presentations are completed, which you can use to ask questions of our panelists. There are green question cards that you can fill out at that point, and we'll have them brought forward and get them answered for you. So let's get to the program. As John said, we have a terrific group of experienced and articulate panelists assembled. And leading off on my left is Judy Hibbard, who's a senior researcher and professor at the University of Oregon. She's been working for more than a quarter a century on consumer choices and consumer behavior in healthcare. If you want to know how consumers use hospital report card information, for example, Judy's the go-to person. She's done the cutting-edge work in how to measure patient activation. Judy, thanks very much for coming a long way to share your experience with us.
Thank you, and good afternoon. What I'm going to try to do in a few minutes here is address the question, what does it really mean to be an activated, engaged consumer? How much of a difference does it make when people are activated and engaged? And what can we do to help people and to encourage greater involvement and engagement? Is that working? Point it over there. Maybe somebody down there can advance the slides.
Down there. There we go.
Oh, okay. So this is a concept that we've been measuring and researching for a while now. And the definition that we came to after quite a bit of empirical work with experts and patients was that people who are more activated and engaged have the knowledge, the skill, and the confidence to manage their health and their health care. And they also understand that they need to play an active or proactive role in their health. Or, to put it another way, people who are engaged or activated understand what their job is and they are up to the task. What we have found, and what I'm going to do is share with you, we've developed a measure that assesses this in individuals. And having that measurement, we've learned quite a lot about this area. And I'm going to share with you some of the insights and how those insights are being applied to actually do a better job of engaging people. One of our very first insights was how much variation there is in any population group. So if you take a Medicaid population, a Medicare population, a sicker population, you will still see people who are kind of at the high end of this dimension and people who are at the low end of this dimension and everywhere in between. Now, when I tell people that, no one seems very surprised to hear it. So what is surprising is that we treat everyone the same, as if they actually did have all the skill and knowledge and confidence they needed to do the job. And we know that many people do not. One of the insights that we got in our early measurement was that this appears to be a developmental process that people go through on their way to becoming effective self-managers. And we've identified four levels. We've done in-depth interviews with people to really understand what are the issues. And what we saw was that for people at the low end of this dimension who are very disengaged, not activated, they've had a lot of experience with failure. They are overwhelmed. They're discouraged. They don't feel like they can have a positive impact. They have very low self-confidence in their ability to do anything, so they become passive. They have poor problem-solving skills. They may not understand that this is their job. At the high end of activation, you see kind of the mirror opposite. Now, think about this low activated person in what their experience is with healthcare. Especially if they have chronic illness, they'll probably go in and see their doctor and they're told to do 17 different things about how they live their life. Well, someone who's already overwhelmed and discouraged, the usual response to that is to do nothing. And so in some ways, by not really understanding where people are, we may be further discouraging them. Or another way to think about it is the way we treat people in healthcare and not knowing what their skill set is for doing the job we're asking them to do, we're essentially throwing non-swimmers into the deep end of the pool and kind of hoping for the best. So I said I would talk about how much of a difference does it really make to be an engaged, activated consumer. And what we've found is that activation is related to every type of health behavior. Those who are more activated are more likely to engage in all of these types of health behaviors. We got further insights when we started to map activation into actual behaviors. And we took behavioral domains. So this is managing your hypertension. And what we see is that activation level is related to each of the behaviors. But more importantly, what we saw was that some behaviors do not even start until people are pretty high on that dimension, until they're highly activated. And those and behaviors that are more difficult, more complex, that require people to be more assertive, that require them to do sustained action, those kinds of behaviors tend to be mostly people who are more activated that will do them. And as you can see here, they don't do all of them. Okay. So we got some really important insights from that. And one of the more important insights was that we know that people who are not engaged are very have low confidence. And how do people get confidence? They experience success. That's a way to start to build confidence. And so we saw that there were some behaviors that, you know, are realistic for people who are less engaged to start with. And if you start them there, then they will have the opportunity to experience success and to gain some confidence. So, but the kinds of behaviors that we're encouraging people to do are such as be consistent in persistent in asking questions when you don't understand something in the medical encounter. Turns out only the most activated do that. And sadly, it's only the most activated that know where to get quality information and actually use it. So many of the things that we are asking consumers to do are well beyond many of them. So thinking about what is realistic and encouraging small steps, helping people by breaking them down into smaller steps, is going to help people to feel that they can actually do this. This is another insight we got. This was AARP did this study, and they looked at people who are actually pretty ill and who had a recent hospitalization. And what they saw was that people who are less activated or engaged, they are more than twice as likely to be readmitted to the hospital after discharge within 30 days. They're more likely to experience a medical error and to have poor care coordination. This is really important. We're starting to see that some of the CMS demonstration sites are starting to measure activation among patients in the hospital and to support them more effectively because they know that they are more at risk for readmissions, or helping them to prioritize what's really important because you don't want to overwhelm people with big long lists of things they're supposed to do. We learned from a Kaiser Permanente study of the Care Management Institute that measuring activation level in diabetic patients was actually help predict what would happen to those patients in the following 2 years. So knowing their activation score, they could predict whether or not they had a hospitalization, whether or not they had good glycemic control, and whether or not they were adherent to diabetic testing. So what this told us was that this is an important construct, that it's something we can act on, and we can help people to move up. We do know that we do have evidence that people can become more activated and engaged, and we have found that some of the types of strategies that are most helpful are ones that provide peer support, help people with learning problem-solving skills, that change the environment and the social norms. And we've also seen that provider support makes a very big difference with giving people very strategic help in learning how to manage conditions, monitor, and set goals. We've also found that tailoring support to the patient's level of activation is a important way to help them become more activated and to be able to do all the behaviors we're asking them to do. We did do a controlled study where we looked at this in a disease management program, and people, their support was tailored to their level of activation so that they got smaller goals, smaller steps if they were less activated. And we found that it had a significant improvement in their clinical indicators, their adherence, and we also saw that it improved their, reduced their utilization, their ER and hospital utilization, as compared to a usual coaching approach. So what we've learned overall is that we can do a better job. We don't have to throw people into the deep end of the pool. And we know that we can help people gain in their confidence and their skills and their ability to self-manage. But we have to move away from a just one-size-fits-all approach. And in doing so, we can do a better job. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Judy. Thank you, Judy. Next, we turn to Chad Bold, who's a physician on the faculties of both the School of Medicine and the School of Nursing at Johns Hopkins. His current research centers on the idea of guided care, which is an award-winning model for the team care of people with several different chronic conditions. He's currently in the middle also of a fellowship in the CMS Office of Research and Demonstration. So he combines a variety of recent experiences, and we're very pleased to have you with us, Chad.
Thank you very much. Everybody here okay?
You got to press the button there.
How's that? All right. Thank you. I'm going to tell you today about a program that endeavors to promote patient self-management through their primary care practice. This is a program that focuses on people who have multiple chronic problems, not for the healthy people, but for the people who are at highest risk for bad outcomes and account for most of the spending of our Medicare program. I want to acknowledge that a couple of people on the panel here, or organizations here, have been partners in this. AARP was with us right from the beginning on this, and Dr. Hibbard's work helped to inform what we're doing in our measurement of outcomes. What I'm going to do in the next few minutes is to, I'm going to present you a patient so you get a sense of the kind of person for whom this program is designed. And then I'm going to briefly describe how this program, it's called Guided Care, how it works in a little bit of detail, but we don't have enough time to go into too much. Then I'm going to very briefly present you with a summary of the results that we've seen so far in a large multi-site randomized trial that we've been conducting. And I'll end up with a slide that shows where you can get further resources if you want. We've made a lot of resources available to other organizations and practices that would like to adopt this model. But first, let's start with our patient. This is Mrs. Marion Chen. Mrs. Chen is a 79-year-old widow who was a retired school teacher and now lives alone. She gets by on a modest income of her Social Security, her teacher's pension, and she has Medicare. Fortunately, she has a devoted daughter who lives only 10 miles away, but her daughter has three teenagers of her own and a job and a family and a life, and is, you'll see in a little bit, a bit busy trying to help her mom. Mrs. Chen has five chronic conditions, just the usual, the common conditions of older people. She sees three physicians regularly and takes eight prescription medications in divided doses every day. Anybody know people like this? Right, of course. This is the kind of person for whom this guided care model of activation is designed. In 2009, Mrs. Chen had, and if we can, I guess I don't have a pointer here, but we can, this one?
That's it.
Doesn't seem to do anything. I think the battery's dead. All right, so I'm going to walk you through this. This is the story of Mrs. Chen's 2009. If we start at about 4 o'clock, we see that she's had three hospital admissions because her chronic conditions flared up. Those were followed by a total going around clockwise of 6 weeks in various subacute rehab institutions, and actually two different nursing homes. Now we're up to about 8 o'clock. She's had a total of 5 months of home care following the rehab from two different home care agencies. Up to about 11 o'clock, she was referred to six different community agencies, filled 22 prescriptions of her eight medications, and over at 3 o'clock had 19 outpatient visits. Is this exaggerated for a person like Mrs. Chen? No, it's not at all. This is just a year in the life of a person with multiple chronic conditions. On the outside ring, you see that she's seen eight, in this past year alone, has seen eight physicians, six social workers, five physical therapists, four OTs, and 37 nurses. And they all have to somehow communicate with each other. So you get a sense of the problem, who this is for. This is Mrs. Chen again. She's confused by all this, all the care, all the medications, all the things she's supposed to do, and as a result is a bit non-adherent. She doesn't do everything she's supposed to do, not because she doesn't want to. It's just a bit much. She relies heavily on her daughter to help her stay organized, take her meds, go to her appointments, and so on. There's her daughter. The picture tells the story with her daughter. She's at work, but is she really? She's at the moment on the phone with a home care nurse because her mom doesn't quite look right to the home care nurse. Her daughter is stressed out. She's had to reduce her work to half-time already, and despite everyone's desire to the contrary, is considering putting her mom into a nursing home. At the bottom, you see that Medicare is not too happy either. They've spent over $42,000 a year paying for her care this year alone. So, again, that's the problem that this model is designed to address. From the Medicare perspective, she falls into the high-risk category. This is a pie chart shows the total Medicare spending for the most recent year that's available, which is 2008. $468 billion is represented by that pie. And the red wedge is the spending on people who have five or more chronic conditions. So it's 68% or two-thirds of the spending on this small minority of people with all these chronic conditions. So it's a real priority item for the sustainability of the Medicare program as well. What is guided care? How does it work? Well, it's comprehensive, coordinated care for patients who have chronic conditions, and it also addresses their families. And the way it works is fairly simple. A registered nurse with special training is placed into a primary care practice where that nurse works with the primary care doctors to do a variety of activities that I'll show you in a minute. But they're partners. The nurse teams with usually 2 to 5 physicians in caring for a total of around 50 or 60 of these high-risk patients like Mrs. Chen. This is a list of what the nurse does in collaboration with the physician. Begins with a home assessment. Patient goes out to the patient's home and does a comprehensive, very structured assessment of the patient, the family, the home environment, everything you'd need to know. From that information, the nurse then, with the physician and the patient and family, all collaborating together, they come up with a plan. We call it a care guide. And from that care guide, the nurse derives a patient-friendly version called an action plan, which is written in big font, simple language that anyone with a sixth grade education can understand, and it serves as a reminder of what the patient is supposed to do, what medicines to take, what to eat and not eat, what to do physically, what to check on oneself, like weight and blood pressure, and when to see the doctor. So that's a reminder in a plastic jacket with a magnet goes up on the refrigerator or the cupboard at home and serves to engage the patient and the family in self-care. Now, once that's set up, we're down to about the third line now. The nurse monitors the patient every month. They have at least a phone call, if not an in-person visit. And the nurse checks to see if there's anything new emerging with this patient or family, and also goes over that action plan to determine how well the patient and family are able to adhere to it. And then when there's problems, and inevitably there are problems, the nurse uses something called motivational interviewing, which is a technique for encouraging patients to get involved in their own care based on their own goals, not the medical system's goals. Another major activity for the nurse is to smooth transitions in and out of hospitals. Basically holds the hand of the patient through that whole hospitalization experience until the patient is back to status quo and back to the regular primary doctor. The nurse also uses the care guide as a communication tool with all the other providers that see this patient. Remember all those people that saw Mrs. Chen? They all would have a copy of the care guide, so everyone stays on the same page. The nurse also educates and supports the family caregivers, giving them information about their loved one, about how to be a good caregiver, about community resources, and that leads us to the last item, which is access to community resources. Many people don't know what's available to them, and the nurse does, so she links them up. So that's in a very quick rundown, that's what a guided care nurse does. I'm going to emphasize the self-management aspects of this because it is one of the major pillars of the underlying guided care. It begins with that assessment at the patient's home that I mentioned. The first question the nurse asks is, if I could do 3 things to make your life better related to your health, what would they be? Tries to find out what the patient cares about and then builds this plan based on the patient's values and priorities. And then when the plan has been drafted, she takes the plan back to the patient and the family, again, trying to get buy-in from them, because if they don't own the plan, they're not going to follow it. These monthly follow-up calls that I mentioned where they go over how the adherence and the nurse helps the patient and family to overcome non-adherence, the motivational interviewing, and the support for the family caregiver. They're the unsung heroes of chronic care, and so the nurse pays a lot of attention to supporting the family caregiver as well. So we did a randomized trial of about a little over 900 people of 49 primary care practices. They were organized in 14 teams, and so half of the teams randomly were assigned to get the nurse, and the other half, the other seven teams, continued just providing usual care to their high-risk patients. And we compared the outcomes in the high-risk patients of these two groups. And I'm going to show you a brief summary of what we found. Actually, this is just who these patients were. Basically, they were people in their upper, on average, big range, but on average, about upper 70s, about half black, half white, half male, female, half with high school education and half without. About a third of them lived alone. They had a little over four chronic conditions on average. Their risk score, HCC score, was a little twice normal. A third of them had functional difficulty, and a few of them had cognitive impairment. So when we gave this program to half of them and compared it, the outcomes to people just like them in the same practices with the same level of illness, here's what we found was the difference after a year. The quality of care was double in the group that got guided care compared to the controls that did not. The physicians were significantly more satisfied with their ability to care for their high-risk chronically ill patients. The family caregivers, if they had a nurse, a guided care nurse involved, their stress level or strain level actually went down a little bit, whereas the family caregivers that didn't have a nurse to work with, their stress level went up in the first year because their loved one got older and sicker, probably. The nurses were very satisfied with this job, lots of interesting quotes from them, and probably most important, it resulted in a net cost savings. That's even after you account for the cost of the nurse, basically the salary, the benefits, the equipment, the travel, everything that a nurse costs. There was enough reduction in hospitalizations and things related to hospitalizations to more than offset the cost of the intervention. That is, there was about 11% net cost savings with this program. So we think it has a bright future. The study isn't done. These are just first-year data, and we'll be turning out papers reporting each year of data as it comes in and gets analyzed. I want to just finish up with a note here on the resources that we've made available to other organizations that would perhaps want to adopt this approach. There's an implementation manual, which is a small book published by Springer that walks a practice through step-by-step what they would have to do if they wanted to adopt this model. There's an online course for registered nurses who want to become guided care nurses, and if they successfully pass the test at the end of it, they get a certificate from the American Nurses Credentialing Center, a certificate in guided care nursing. There's also an online course for doctors and practice leaders who want to learn how to adopt this kind of a model. And all this is available through our two websites, guidedcare.org and medhomeinfo.org. And let me just put up for your perusal the very important funders of this work that we could not have done it without. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Chad. We turn next to Don Kemper, who's the head of HealthWise and also the founder of the Center for Information Therapy, which is a phrase he's going to explain to you a little bit. He's, for a long time, been an advocate of arming patients with the information they need to ask for and get the care they need and refuse the care they don't need. So we're very pleased to have you contribute to this conversation. Don?
Thank you, Ed. I'm really pleased to be here. And as this slide says, our system is perfectly designed to deliver the outcomes that it delivers, as every system is. It is perfectly designed to do really good, high-tech, high-specialty care, and we have the best in the world for that. And it's perfectly good for, perfectly designed to do transplants and change body parts and all sorts of things like that. But it's not designed for primary care. It's not designed for coordinating care. And it's certainly not designed to help people do more for themselves. And I think that's what we're here today to talk about. How do we get this system to be redesigned around encouraging each of us to be more involved and more successfully involved with our health? So let's see if this is, there we go. All right, so this is me. I attended in a room not very far from here a long time ago a meeting with Vern Wilson, who was then an assistant secretary. Oops, there we go. There's Vern. An assistant secretary for health, education, and welfare back in 1970. And he said something that changed my life and has had me focused for the last 40 years. He said the greatest untapped resource in healthcare is the consumer. And, you know, he's still right. He would probably be disappointed with how far we've come in 40 years, but we have made a lot of progress, and we're right at the precipice of doing a huge amount more. If we can, there is no way healthcare reform can solve the crisis in healthcare without the help of the patient, and that's what we're after. So a few years later, I founded this not-for-profit organization, HealthWise, in Boise, by God, Idaho. And we started off with this little book, this little three-ring binder, the HealthWise Handbook. Doesn't this work? There we go. The HealthWise Handbook. Now some 34 million copies of this are in the U.S. and Canada. It's been used, you know, significantly. Certainly there are more families that don't have it than have it, but it's of value. And HealthWise has grown up into this organization with about 220 employees. Last year, we counted about 111 million times that people came to our content to help them with our mission, which is to help people make better health decisions. So some impact. We get very little support from the government and none from pharma, but we're, you know, we could always use more from the government. We follow three rules. The basic is the self-care rule. Help people do as much for themselves as they can. Just like in every other aspect of our society, we're given the tools, usually now web-based tools, to be our own travel agents, to be our own website designers, to edit our own movies. Why can't we learn to do more for our own health? And I think we can. Second rule is the guidelines rule. Help people ask for the care they need by giving them access to the medical guidelines translated for the consumer so they know really what care is appropriate. And help them say no. We call it the veto rule. Help them say no to care that's just not right for them. Let them have a say. They are the autonomous body here. And we do this through something called information therapy. How many of you know this term, familiar with this term? It's a growing movement. This is good. All right, it's the simplest definition is just prescribing the right information to the right person at the right time as part of the process of care, not separate, as part of the process of care. And we all know what an RX is, right, a medication prescription. We want you to think about an IX. Every time you go to the doctor, you should be getting an information prescription, a prescription of the information that will help you do your part in managing this illness at this point in time. Okay, so it changes the fundamental role of information in healthcare from one in which information is about your care to one in which information is care. It is as important to your care as the test you get or the drugs you get or the surgery you get because your information can save your life. It needs to be raised to that status in healthcare, and we know how to do it. So keep in mind this phrase, patient-specific education resources. How many of you have heard that lately? A few of you, and it's in the meaningful use rules. All right, we're going to talk about it. All right, the problem is we would like the doctor to prescribe this information, and the doc has a rough time doing it because he or she has to do it specific to your demographics and whatever language you speak. And they have to do it related to where you are in healthcare right at this moment. in terms of, are you in the emergency room? Are you being released from the hospital? Are you in an outpatient visit? And it has to be related to your diagnosis and the test you just got and the drugs you just got. So they don't have time to look up the information that's right for you. And they don't have time to document it, which they would have to do if they were going to be good practicing docs. And they really don't even have time to leave their EMR application to go do any of that. So that's been a bit of a problem, but there's a solution to it. And the solution is this HL7 standard. HL7, Health Level 7, is a international set of standards around medical information. They've created this new standard. It's called the info button for short, but it's really the context-aware knowledge retrieval standard. And let's we go to the next. All right. So if you think of you're a doc sitting at your electronic health record, your EHR, and you push this info button, it then moves to, it makes a, hit it again. It sends, ooh, we missed something. I don't know what. It sends a knowledge request to a database with all of that information embedded in the knowledge request. We let the computer do the basic work of matching it up to language, matching it up to the lab test you're in, and then it sends back the knowledge response that lands on the physician's desktop. The physician just has a menu to choose from, chooses the piece, it's automatically documented into the record, and it's printed, handed to the patient, and automatically sent to the PHR. So that's the standard that allows you to do that. Every EMR company could use the same standard. Every content company could match its content to the same standard so that the physician's job is very easy. We've been doing this with the Alta program for the DOD. We do it with Epic, with Kaiser. We do it with other organizations. So the three things that I want all of you to take back to focus on in healthcare reform is first to focus on meaningful use, and it relates directly to this. So let's go to the next. What's meaningful for the patient? Patients, the only thing that's meaningful for the patient is help me make better decisions. Do I need this test? Do I need this drug? Do I need this surgery? That would be meaningful if you can help me do that. And fortunately, the Health Policy Committee of the Office of the National Coordinator put in a little different words, put that into their recommendations to CMS. And CMS even said, boy, this is critical to patient engagement. But they said there's a paucity of knowledge resources that have been integrated into the EMR. Well, I've just spent 40 years trying to put this into this state. So it's kind of a strange thing that they didn't come ask the industry what's available, but they didn't. And I think there's now a chance for them to change that decision, and I think they're getting a lot of good input. And I hope it will come from you, too, because if this health information technology is to be meaningful to the patient, it has to give them information that will answer their questions and guide them in their self-care. If we go next. So there's no paucity. The technology is in place. And the critical thing is we know of lots of places where you have given access to the patient's information to the patient, but not explained what it means. What does it do? They pick up the phone and call the office. It is a disruption. It really does slow down the practice of medicine. But if you insert information that helps them to explain the data, that gives them good instruction on what they do about it, then it doesn't. And so this is an important thing just to keep workflow going in the clinics. Okay, and then one more. There's also, even though CMS recommended that patients have access to their information, there's a lot of pushback from the docs who say, ooh, I don't know if we want to do that. But they have to do it, and sooner or later they will do it. And wherever it's been done, the docs have been happy about it. Kaiser, Group Health, Palo Alto Medical Foundation, the docs get hero letters from their patients because of this. Let's go to the next. So the second thing I want to say is focus your attention on patient decision aids. This is probably the most powerful part of the consumer health information arsenal of stuff. Help people make better decisions. And we don't have time right now, but maybe in Q&A somebody will ask for a little demo of this, and we can do that. All right. But the Cochrane reviews have shown that through 55 randomized clinical trials that these decision aids increase knowledge, and what they really increase is your understanding of your risk for doing it and your risk for not doing it. If you hit it again. And that it has an impact. When people know their risk, they say, no, thank you. I don't think I need this back surgery now. By 24% less surgery when that's done. We'll go again. Okay. And all right, so then the third thing that I want to say you can do is that if you really want to make a difference with Medicare, take the fairly flimsy program called MyMedicare.gov and boost it up to become a real valuable decision support tool for Medicare beneficiaries and their caregivers. And all the information is available to do that. It just needs the leadership and the will to make it happen. And let's see if we're close to the end here. Oh, and here in your packets, you can see access to a whole string of these demonstrations and tools that you can look up 158 different decision aids and see if it affects you or a person in your family and test it out. You'll see if you prescribe this kind of information to every person that's facing a decision, you'll see an impact around patient engagement and around the outcomes of healthcare. So thank you.
Great, Don. Thank you.
That's a lot worse. I don't think it does ease you in at all.
Thanks, Don. Finally, Mike Sokol will address us. Mike is the corporate medical director for Merck & Company. He's in charge of maximizing the health of Merck's own employees worldwide. That gets him into the business of overseeing their employee health clinics, disability management, healthcare benefits, and wellness programs. And he's an expert in areas like population health and disease management, value-based benefit design, which we've heard a lot about, and quality improvement. Mike, thanks for sharing these wide experiences with us today. Okay. Look forward to hearing you.
Great. Ed, thank you so much, and good afternoon, everybody. This is just about the time when all the blood is rushing to your stomach to digest all that food that you had, so hopefully you won't all start falling asleep, so I'll try to keep you awake and engaged this afternoon. My topic is to talk a little bit about value-based insurance design or value-based benefit design. Some call it value-based health management. It's essentially looking at evidence-based medicine. What is the evidence that a certain intervention, a drug, a medical therapy, a treatment really will have benefit for patients, better clinical outcomes for the patient, but also can it yield better financial outcomes for the payers of healthcare? So what I'm going to do is review some of the evidence in the literature that looks at some companies that have instituted value-based benefit design and see what impact that they've had. So just to set it up a little bit, the first study was the lead author here, Dr. Ron Kessler from Harvard Medical School. And this was looking at the association between copayments adherence, medication adherence over time. This particular example is with diabetes. And what you can see in the vertical axis was their adherence, one meaning 100%, that the patients were taking their medicine 100% of the time, zero meaning that they're not taking their medication at all. And the different lines represent different copayments. So the top black bar represents a $0 copayment. These were diabetics that did not have to pay anything for their medication. All the way down to that light blue or that teal line, which were patients that had the highest copay, $31 or more. What you can see is that over time, patients are likely to drop off therapy, even those at a $0 copay. But what's interesting, what's striking about this graph, is that people are much more likely to drop off of therapy much quicker when they have to pay more for their medication. So when you look at all the barriers to why people don't take their medicine, there are a number of issues. They forget, they're in denial, they're worried about side effects. But cost is an important issue as well, and we have to be mindful of that and be able to make sure that we lower any of these barriers to why patients don't take their medication. So in this example, seeing that the higher copayments really can have a negative impact on their adherence. So the next study was the lead author here, Dr. Mike Chernu, who is a health economist, also at Harvard Medical School. Now it's looking at the issue of what's the relationship between income and medication adherence and copayment. So looking at a group of diabetics, Dr. Chernu looked at those classes of drugs that these diabetics are likely to take. There are oral diabetes medication, ACE and ARB, these are classes of drugs used for high blood pressure, and the statins are drugs used for high cholesterol. And what we can see is, again, we have four bars, those at the lowest level of income, less than $30,000 a year, all the way to the white bar, which are patients that had the highest level of income, $62,000 a year or more. And again, what you can see is people that have the lower incomes are less likely to be taking their medication than those at the highest. So, for example, if you look at the statins, you can see that only about 62 or 63% of patients that make less than $30,000 a year are taking their medication at a certain level of copayment versus those that are making over $62,000 a year, their adherence is almost 77%. So clearly when designing benefits or interventions, we have to be mindful that those consumers that make less money are much more impacted by copayment level. So the next study, and this is exciting because this study actually came out in 2008 in Health Affairs, and it was also led by Dr. Mike Chernu at Harvard with his colleague Dr. Mark Fendrick, who is at the University of Michigan. Mark and Mike have been working for a number of years on this whole issue of value-based benefit design. They had an employer come to them, a very large company in the service industry, that said, we're very interested in this idea. We want to actually do an intervention, but we want to design it in a way that we can measure it and really see the outcomes. So what this company did is they chose several classes of drugs, again, that have been demonstrated to be of high value to patients, and they lowered their copays by 50%. So there was a greater than 50% reduction in the copayment. And these patients were followed over time. And the other important piece is that it's not just the copayment, as I mentioned. There's other factors, such as getting patients to understand why they need to take care of themselves, what they need to do, why they need to take their medication, why they need to diet and exercise and so forth. And so what was done in the study is that the company that lowered the copay also had a very active disease management program for these patients. But they also compared this to another company that had the same disease management program but did not have any change in their copayment level. So with that, and I know this may be a little bit confusing and I just have a few minutes, but the way to look at this is the very top set of lines, where you can see they're almost on top of each other. There's a solid gray line with a dotted line. These were the diabetics in the company that had a very active disease management program but did not lower their copay. And the gray bar represents their adherence before and the dotted line after. Now, they did not have the copay change. So you can see that the year before and the year after, their adherence was the same. There was really no change. But the second set of lines below, that was the company that had the disease management but also lowered those copays by 50%. And what you can see is that the black line represents their adherence before the copays were reduced. The dotted gray line was their adherence after the copays were reduced. And you can see there's about a 5% difference now, unlike the control company. So there was a 5% increase in adherence. Patients now, they were getting education, their medicine was more affordable, they were more likely to be adherent to their medication. So with that, a lot of folks were saying, well, that's great. It seems like the evidence is pretty clear that, raising copays will reduce adherence or lowering copays will increase adherence. But ultimately, what does that mean? Is there any value in that? What's the impact of that? So Chernu and Fendrick and others decided to look at then the financial outcomes of this intervention. And this just came out in January. It was on the Health Affairs website, and I believe it's in this month's issue of the print journal. And what they found was that while there was an increase in drug costs, the company had to pay more now for the drug costs because copays were lowered. What they found is that there was a reduction in medical costs. So these patients were less likely to go into the hospital, less likely to go into the emergency room. And so ultimately, the intervention essentially broke even. So the rise in the drug costs was offset by the decline in the medical, although Dr. Chernu feels that in some cases for certain classes of medications or disease states, there might have been overall savings associated with it. They also concluded that perhaps even a more targeted intervention, looking at those patients that were at the highest risk, could potentially result in even greater savings. The study did not even look at what we call the indirect costs. So for those of us that are employers and are concerned about our own populations and the costs of our employees for health care, it's important to look at these other issues like productivity and disability and absenteeism. There could be a lot of improvements in those areas as well. That study did not look at that, but there are some studies out there that have demonstrated that improvement in adherence, getting consumers more engaged in their health care, can in fact improve productivity and reduce absenteeism. The next example, which is a really great one, and many of you may have heard of this. In fact, I think it was on NBC News a year or two ago as a story, is the city of Asheville, North Carolina. And this is the city now as an employer. They were one of the first to really engage in a value-based insurance design program. Again, we'll focus on diabetes since that's such an important disease right now for our country. Unfortunately, the number of diabetics is increasing year after year. It's a real problem in the United States. But what this program did, again, was combining that consumer or that patient engagement with value-based insurance design. So patients, diabetics that worked for the city were told that they could go to the pharmacy, get their diabetes medicine and their supplies for free, but in order to do that, they had to agree to engage in educational programs. So to meet with certified diabetes educators, to sit down with the pharmacist and talk to them about their diabetes, to meet with their doctors and understand what they have to do to take care of themselves. And so they follow these diabetics over a long period of time. And the next slide shows some of the results. So what you can see at baseline all the way to the left, these are diabetics that just enter the program. They're not really taking their medicine. They're not taking care of their diabetes. They're not watching their diet. They're not really exercising. And you can see that the top couple of bars there, the white bar and the gray bar, represents their drug costs. These folks are really non-adherent to their medication. The black bar represents their medical costs, which are very significant. And when you look over time, all the way up to 5 years, what you see is that people that were engaged in this program the longest, while their drug costs now are a little bit higher because they're now adherent, they're now taking care of themselves, look at their medical costs. They're greatly reduced. And when you add all their costs together, their drug and their medical, in fact, their total costs are the lowest, much lower than they were at baseline. So showing that getting patients to engage in taking care of themselves can really make an impact. The next one is a study that I had the pleasure of authoring many years ago when I worked at Medco Health Solutions, the large pharmacy benefit manager. This was a very large company that was very interested in understanding if medication adherence improvement can lead to savings on the medical side. And if you just jump to the next slide, and if you go a couple more, so it'll show the vertical and the horizontal. Yes, thank you. Very similar to the Asheville example. If you look all the way to the left, these are diabetics that are only taking their medicine 1 to 19% of the time. They're really pretty non-adherent to their own treatment. You can see their drug costs are only about $55 per diabetic per year. Their medical costs are about $8,800. But those diabetics all the way to the right that were 80 to 100% compliant, you can see they had the highest drug costs now, $763 per diabetic per year. They're much more likely to be taking their medicine. But again, look at their medical costs. $3,800. So in fact, the most adherent patients had the lowest total healthcare costs. And what was really driving this was a reduction in hospitalizations. You can see that folks that are the least adherent have about a 30% rate of hospitalization for diabetes. Those that are the most adherent had only about a 13% rate of hospitalization. So with that, this is my final slide. You know, what my recommendation is to other employers and to anybody out there who's paying for health care is that you really need to look at your own data, whether it's an employer, whether it's a health plan, whether it's the government, any government-sponsored health plan. It's looking at the data and understanding what are those disease states that patients are not taking care of themselves. What's the problem with medication adherence? Why are people not doing what they need to do? And it's looking at that data to then make these benefit design changes, looking at, again, those services that have been demonstrated through evidence-based medicine or evidence-based guidelines to have the most value and making those services most available to those patients and making sure that they're doing it. The design has to be clear. It has to be simple. And the delivery, as all of my distinguished predecessors have said, it has to engage a result in sustainable behavioral change. It's got to be having the patients take ownership for their disease and to do something about it. And adherence, whether it's to medicine, whether it's to medical therapy, whether it's to behavioral therapy, whatever it is, it's making sure that patients are adherent to their treatment plan. And ultimately, in just the few minutes I've had, I think I've been able to show you that in some published studies, that getting consumers, getting patients engaged, getting them to do the things they need to do, can in fact not only improve their clinical status, which of course is the most important thing, but ultimately in certain cases can lead to overall savings as well. And in fact, this is the approach we're taking at Merck. I'm not a salesperson for the company. I'm the corporate medical director. It's, again, as Ed said, it's my job to look out for the health and welfare of our own employees. And I have a number of colleagues in the corporate medical director world, and we're all looking at these issues. In fact, I was on a webinar yesterday with the National Business Group on Health. A number of employers were there, and over 75% said that they're looking at doing some type of value-based insurance design. And so we at Merck have been looking at our data. I'm relatively new to the company. I've only been with Merck for about a year now. In fact, all the studies I showed you were all done before I got to Merck. But in my new job now, I'm looking at our data and saying, what are those disease states where we're having issues with our population? Where am I seeing that our patients are not as adherent to their medication? And we're, in fact, right now in the process of looking at changing our own benefit design to try to get our own patients engaged in improving their behavior and getting them to do what they have to do, and ultimately, hopefully, saving money for the company as well. A number of these studies, I believe, are in your packet, and certainly look forward to having further discussion in the Q&A. And looks like you all stayed awake, so I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. You now have the opportunity to offer questions and comments. There are microphones here and in the back. There are green cards that you can fill out and hold up, and we'll bring them forward. And let me just take this opportunity to remind you there is an evaluation form in your materials that we'd very much appreciate you taking the time to fill out before you leave so that we can improve these programs and make them more useful to you as time goes by. Mike, let me just start with you while we're getting the microphones arranged. If 75% of the companies are already doing it and it's self-evident that it's saving money, what are the policy implications? Do we need to do anything as a matter of policy to incentivize people to do something that's going to save them money and improve the health of their workers?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Ed. And again, on this webinar yesterday, I should clarify that of the 75%, 50% said that they were actually doing it, 25% were considering doing it. And while I did show you some evidence that some of these interventions can save money, we still have a long way to go. We haven't been able to show that for every disease state or every class of medication. I mean, these were selected studies in certain areas. And to be honest, I think that a lot more research does have to be done to still demonstrate the financial value of all these different types of services. Having said that, though, where there is pretty clear evidence, and I think diabetes is a great example, where so many studies have been published to show that that getting people engaged in their behavior and getting them to take their medication can result in better outcomes and better savings. I would think that the policy implications there would be that we want to make these services and these interventions more affordable for patients. So hopefully, as we see where health reform is going, I think it's really important for policymakers to look at, again, these evidence-based guidelines, see where there's clear outcomes that certain services can yield better outcomes, and ideally make those services and those interventions affordable for patients, because at the end of the day, I think it ultimately can, you know, result in some savings. And I think I would just lastly add that I think preventive services is a really huge part of that. I think there was some of that in some of the proposals that Congress has been making, but you know, clearly, and my specialty is preventive medicine. I think it's important that if we can do things to prevent people in the first place from getting sick. I mean, I think we all agree we'd love to get people to a point where they don't have to take medicine or they don't have to go into the hospital or they don't have to do all these other things. And so if we can prevent things in the first place, I think that would be really critical as well.
Good. Chad, did I incense you were about to press that button? All right. We have some folks lined up with microphones. Would ask you to identify yourself and be as brief as you possibly can.
I'm Julie Cantor-Weinberg with the College of American Pathologists, and I had a question for Dr. Volt. Could you explain the differences between the model he presented here today and the medical home? It seemed like there's a fair amount of overlap. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. I'm glad to clear that up. First of all, the medical home is a very broad concept that there's no formally accepted definition for as yet. But you can think of the guided care as a type of medical home for a subset of the patients that get care at a practice. In other words, medical home basically serves all the patients. This guided care nurse works specifically on those people that are at the highest risk of being high utilizers, but basically providing them with intensive medical home services. Got cleared up? Thank you.
Chad, let me just read one of the questions that has come up on a card because it follows, I think, quite rationally from that comment. You mentioned the guided care nurse, and the question is, do you have to have an RN to do guided care, or can a social worker or a medical assistant do it?
We looked at all those options and decided that because of the level of complexity of the patients that we were focusing on, that it had to be an RN. Now, a lot of the other activities involved in engaging patients in their own care can be done by people with lower levels of training. And there's been a lot of work on this, even to see if medical assistants can provide them. But when you're dealing with people like Mrs. Chen, you really, because of the medical complexity and the need for this nurse person to interact with physicians regularly, ER docs, hospital docs, primary care docs, specialists, you really need to have somebody who is going to gain their attention and respect.
I'm Bob Rohr with BMJ. Two separate questions. First for Dr. Hibbard. Have you seen in patient activation, have you seen any different associations with socioeconomic, educational levels, things like this, or does it pretty much apply across the board?
That's an excellent question. What we've seen is that there is an association, but it's not that strong. It accounts for about 5% of the variation, those socioeconomic education, age, income accounts for about 5% of the variation in activation. So it's significantly related, but it's weak. So in any group, even in Medicaid or a very elderly population, you'll still see high and low activated individuals.
Secondly, I'd be curious to hear from a number of the speakers of what does one do when groups are resistant to accepting the medical evidence? I'm thinking on the physician side of things like, you know, rates of C-sections that vary across regions. On the consumer side, there are things like reactions to the recent breast screening recommendations where people don't want to believe the evidence on all sides of this.
Our experience in talking to consumers about evidence and treatment decisions has been a little bit sobering in that consumers don't really view evidence as that providers are using evidence to make choices as a criteria for choosing providers. They think that's a rather low bar. And, if providers are following guidelines, that's, they want providers to tailor what they're doing to their situation. So it's not as easy a sell always to consumers, especially when it's couched in the quality language and the kind of provider choice.
I'd add a comment specific to the recent experience on mammography and also the very recent experience with the PSA test. I think the American Cancer Society came out with a changed guidance on PSA tests in the last 2 days, again saying that in this case, there's not enough evidence for us to tell you what's the right thing to do. You have to talk with the patient and show them the risks on both sides, and that is specific guidance from the ACS. Patients will, it depends on where they are on Judy's scale, how they're going to deal with that. Those who are activated are going to say, give me the information, let me decide. And the others will say, well, doc, just make a decision for me. And that's okay.
My name is Warren Greenberg from George Washington University. Thus far, I think the panel hasn't said too much about the health insurer. But what better party to provide information if indeed they had the incentives to the consumer than the health insurer? A health insurer with physicians on their staff, with economists on their staff, with knowledgeable people like the people on this panel on their staff, saying to patients, look, if you do more preventive exercise, we're going to reduce your premium. If you if you go to the hospital A, which all the evidence shows is a much better hospital than hospital B, we're going to pay 100% as opposed to 85%. This is the informed consumer. And do you think perhaps incorrect here, or I just wanted to throw the health insurer into the ballpark when we're talking about consumer sovereignty?
Good.
Medicare, Medicaid, or the private insurer?
Well, I'll talk to the private health insurers first. That, they have two problems in doing it. They're all doing it. Like our content, of the 10 largest health plans, all 10 license our content, make it available on their websites. But they have two problems. One is they have a trust problem. People don't necessarily trust their insurer, and that's hard for them to get over. Two, and I'm sorry, ARP, I don't know, maybe they're different. I don't know, maybe you're different. And two is they have a time problem. They get data about their patients too late in most cases to help people make decisions. It's, by the time the claim data gets to the insurer, the decisions have already been made. So in that case, for a lot of things, they're not able to impact it to the degree you'd like them to, and I'd like them to. And it needs to be moved back to the doc. I think that CMS hasn't really gotten to this issue where they've thought that's part of their job yet, but I think it will become part of their job.
Thank you. Very helpful.
We are starting to see some movement in this direction that's interesting. So some insurers are looking at this idea of engagement and activation, and they're saying, if we really knew about our whole population, well, couldn't we be a lot more efficient in the way that we support them? So if we knew about the population, we could reach out to that low end, the low activated, with a much more high touch, reach out to them because they're passive. They're not going to come in for the programs or seek out the information. And with the high activated, we can just push out information because they're ready, and we can be more efficient in supporting the population that way.
John?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to go back to something Don showed earlier, which is a 24% reduction in surgery when people are exposed to information. So the question really is, who do you trust as a patient? Here you have your surgeon recommending that you have a procedure, and you have your health insurer saying, well, maybe not. I'm actually surprised that you got 24% reduction, because my assumption is that most patients would trust the person they know, not the impersonal insurer whose motives they might suspect. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
I think in most of those trials, those randomized clinical trials, probably done in university clinical settings where it's not coming from the insurer but from the clinical side itself.
So is it transferable, in other words, to the insurance context, or do you need someone with medical credibility making these kinds of information available?
I think the credibility is really important, and how do you establish that credibility? Certainly, there are some people who trust their insurer, and for those people it works. There are some people who trust them a little bit. There are some people who are so desperate for getting good information, they'll review anything. But if you can move this to the clinical side, if you can make it part of meaningful use in the electronic medical record so the doc just has to click, and if you can reimburse the doc for doing it, you've really met Vern Wilson's dream of tapping this untapped resource and helping people really become engaged in their own care.
I'd make one comment on that.
Dr. Sokol comments on the incentives of the provider in this. Maybe the provider is somewhat biased in different times.
Well, you know, it's a good point. And you know, we've been spending a lot of time talking about the consumer and consumer engagement, but clearly we have to engage the physicians as well. And, you know, it's getting them also to understand using evidence-based medicine, in some cases giving them some incentives. For example, I didn't mention in the Asheville project, you know, the pharmacist that would sit down and meet with the patients and do the counseling. It was wonderful they did that, but the city did have to give them some financial incentive to do that. So I think it is also looking at both the doctor and the patient and making sure we're engaging both of them and getting them both to do what needs to be done, because it is, I think, a joint responsibility and a joint relationship. Thank you.
Yeah, we definitely need to change the incentives that physicians and other providers have to do more. However, I think that this crossing this divide of having insurance companies begin to try to convince patients of what they should have and what they shouldn't have is a dangerous divide to go over. And I think the much preferable path is to have the insurance companies do what insurers do, which is pay for health care, but pay it through a reformed health care delivery system that isn't so much driven by volume but more by quality.
Hi, I'm Joanne Lynn, and I was just wanting to invite all of you to think on a somewhat different slant for a second. Not to take away from all the suggestions that you've made, but I'm impressed that we seem to focus heavily on the doctor-patient interaction and the degree to which we can kind of influence doctors to do a little better and nurses in their practices kind of in the same light, and patients one by one. And I think we're not paying enough attention to the kinds of things that would make this systematically work. Make it work over time, every time. Think about it for a minute as a public health issue. Think about it as tobacco control. Think about it as child abuse, something that you must tackle at a community level. And suddenly some other options show up, I think. Things like making it the standard of care, making it very dangerous to take care of patients with diabetes, for example, without getting them capable of self-care at some fairly high rate. Make it supported in evening TV shows and soap operas. You know, the biggest impact on child using seatbelts was when all the TV shows started showing, before starting a chase, the policeman pulling it across and sticking it in, and all of a sudden the rates went from 40 to 70%. I think there's a whole panoply of public health kinds of interventions that, when we sort of think about how to finance one-on-one healthcare, we skip. And a piece of the problem, of course, is we have no actor to take this on. We have nobody whose job it is to figure this out. But we do. We have a whole public health network. We've got Medicare paying, or Medicaid paying for almost all of this care. We own this system. We could set aside some of those kinds of resources. You know, how is it that every hospital in the city here, with the exception of one, discharges people from the emergency room who came in with whopping out-of-control diabetes with not even a prescription for their next medication, but an admonition to go to their medical home? We have not a single diabetes educator in this city who speaks Spanish. And think about it. We've got a population 10% Hispanic. Those are the kinds of things that if you were thinking about it as a public health endeavor, you would think about things like manpower needs, like sustainability, you know, like the supports that keep things in place. Think about it. If you had a drug that had this kind of impact, it would be detailed out there so fast to be the standard of care within 2 years. And yet this one will go on. It's already gone on for a decade. We've known this works. It'll go on for another decade, kind of dribbling around. and because we never quite get the gumption to make it work.
Again, I would point us to the meaningful use rules. Meaningful use says that in order for this to be meaningful, you've got to do it in your practice on a regular basis. Let's just make that one of the requirements and then build it in. I think, you know, it may have been that the TV brought people to seatbelts, but the big impact was really when it became law, when people had to or they could get fined. I think we do the same thing. We tie it to reimbursement of physicians for their EMR support.
Yeah, and I would just add, you bring up an excellent point, and what you're really describing is this concept called population health management. The term a few years ago used to be right disease management. Now it's health management, population health management. What can we do to take care of the patient, not just the disease? But you're right. Ultimately, we take care of one patient at a time, but how do we do it in a public health type of way? And I think there is so much more. And I think one example of that is that, as I mentioned earlier, I believe in the United States we spend so few dollars on prevention and so much more on chronic care that if we could try to refocus and spend more on prevention to get people to be healthy, to get those diabetics before they get out of control. You know, a quick anecdote just from my own family. My parents are both diabetic. And we love to go out to good restaurants, and I live in Philadelphia. We've got great restaurants in Philly. We go to New York, and we sit down, and the dessert menu comes, and I have to say once in a while I enjoy a nice dessert as part of a healthy diet. But my dad every time will say to the server, what do you have on the dessert menu that's sugar-free? And I can name every fancy restaurant in Philadelphia and New York, and not a single one has a sugar-free dessert on the menu. It's unbelievable. With the millions and millions of diabetics, that you can't go to a five-star restaurant in New York City or Philadelphia and find a menu that has a sugar-free dessert. It's unbelievable. So how do we get our society to take a more active role in doing that, in promoting those type of things? And I think we, unfortunately, still have a long way to go to do that.
Decrease subsidies for high fructose sugar.
There you go.
Doug Goldstein from iConnecto. I'd be interested in your comments on the role of the mobile phone, whether it's feature phone or smartphone, in activating and supporting better health. Thank you.
I can respond to that. Harris Interactive just did a study on this, and they looked at both clinicians and consumers, and it's a difficult thing for consumers because they're not there yet, and so it's a little hard for them to speculate on the value of this. But the looking at the providers was interesting. Those that also measured higher on our measure of clinician support for patient activation, who understood more about the patient role and what people have to do on a day-to-day basis, they saw the value of these kinds of mobile devices for their patients and saw value in integrating it into what they were doing. So there is a segment of the clinician population that does see value in it, and Harris Interactive has a whole report that they did on this.
Just do a quick add, which is internationally it's really a big thing because so many people have more mobile access than they have PC access, and so we're going to be learning a lot from other countries as they push the bar on the mobile side.
Tom Miller, American Enterprise Institute. There's a lot of wisdom here, but let me just get zoological for a moment to point out some things that may have been neglected. Elephants in the room and dogs that didn't bark. When we talk about activation, I didn't hear anything about the actual evidence of recent years, which is that, although they're limited, consumer-driven health plans have shown greater activation, more use by the patients of information than other conventional plans. The evidence is in on this. The older McKinsey study from a few years ago, American Academy of Actuaries, you can partly dismiss the insurer studies, but they're about the only empirical evidence out there that shows that in that regard. The other component of activation, a little surprised what Judy said, that it didn't really show up, maybe it's lifetime activation versus instant activation, is there's a long-term correlation between levels of education as a proxy Sometimes you want to get controversial IQ into the people having better health and making better health decisions. Now, maybe that's because they've been activated for a long time and that shows up as opposed to what's being measured here. But let me target a more direct question about the alignment of financial incentives. I've been looking at value-based insurance design for a while. It's a little one-sided. I've never seen a study which decided to find out whether maybe you should pay more for something rather than less in order to avoid being overtreated or perhaps not to use a less effective drug product. Where are those studies going on? I hear about all the ones that say, let's do more. I haven't heard any talk about let's do less.
So we did do a study about consumer-driven health plans, and we did measure activation in the participants in the study. We looked at people who had enrolled in a consumer-driven health plan and people who opted to stay in a PPO. What we saw was that the more activated were more likely to enroll in the consumer-driven health plan. We saw that the more activated were more able to take advantage of the resources and the tools in the consumer-driven health plan. But what we did not see is that the plan design did not activate anyone. We followed people over time, and there was not an increase in activation over that time period. So what we took away from that is that that people who are more activated are better candidates for these kinds of more complex health design plan designs, and they're more able to take advantage of them, but they in themselves do not activate people.
Yeah, and you do bring up a very interesting point with value-based benefit design. In fact, it is
I'm
something
not expecting you folks to sponsor those studies.
You know, it's interesting because I've been working very closely with Mark Fendrick at the University of Michigan for a number of years, and Mark actually talks about that. You know, we have been talking about looking at the you know, services of high value and reducing, right, the copay.
Trade-offs.
What Mark said is, so maybe as an opposite, is for those services or drugs or whatever that have not demonstrated as much value, do you raise the cost for that, you know, to maybe offset it? I think that's a very interesting point, and I think it's something that we should look at.
Tom, I want to just tell you about a program in Chicago. There's an organization called the Health Promotion Institute in Chicago that's been working with one of the unions there, not for their members, but for their employees. And they offer their employees two choices in their health plan. The health improvement plan, there's no premium. There's a fairly low deductible. There's a high limit on lifetime limit, but and in the regular plan there's a fair size premium. It's a, you know, the benefits are about half as good, but you get to choose between the two. In order to choose the good plan, you have to do a health risk assessment. You have to talk with a nurse if you have a chronic disease. You have to get engaged with these issues, and they've shown about a 96%. People say, oh, yeah, I'll take that plan, and I will become more activated as a result because it's pushing me there. And I think it's moved a lot of people. They're showing that their costs have leveled out and that people are healthier as a result.
I'm going to ask a follow-up. It came from the audience, so I think it's a good question, though. I think there is evidence to show that when you put people financially at risk, they pay more attention. But what about non-financial incentives? Are there ways to get people engaged in better health care that don't involve money?
I think that, you know, the key thing there is people change their behavior, particularly when somebody they care about is watching. You know, when there's accountability in some degree, when their doctor not only recommends it but tracks their change.
I thought you meant a spouse.
Well, spouse would work too. I don't know. They don't work on some people. But, you know, I think there's a plan out of Oklahoma, MedIncentive is a company that has aligned incentives between doctors and patients. And one of the things they do is to have the physician, when the physician acknowledges success in the patient's weight loss plan or fitness plan, the physician gets a payment. So, and they're doing it, and the patients are engaged and loving it, et cetera. So I think we need to find a million different ways to accomplish this. But it, the motivation isn't just by money, but it's always by somebody holding you accountable and watching and rewarding or encouraging.
Judy, you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I agree. Having somebody pay attention and be supportive, it makes a difference. And the thing that we have observed is that if you get people to start acting, even in very small ways, they start, especially those who are pretty passive, they start to see that, yes, I can do this. And that's when their motivation kicks in. It's showing themselves that they can do this. And the way that we've found is just making it easier for them to do it. And some of these things that like Mike is talking about, makes it easier for people. But making it easier by asking them to do what's realistic for them helps. Being empathetic. And we've also seen that patients who have more trust in their doctor are more likely to be more activated, and patients who say that their doctor helped them in very specific ways, like helped them learn how to monitor, helped them set up a goal, they are more activated. So it's the people around you, and it's also making it seem doable. The other thing that we have observed is really working, trying to whittle away people's feelings of being overwhelmed. That's one of the key barriers. And if you can do that, even by giving people permission to not do everything that they've been told they have to do, that almost frees them up to start acting because they're so weighted down by their feelings that of all that they're supposed to be doing and that they know they can't.
I should say, go ahead.
Just yeah. A reminder, too, about the importance of dealing with the patient's goals for their health. That comes before any of the rest of it. If you assess what does the patient want, and they want things that are different from what health professionals want. They want to be able to walk to the shopping mall again. They want to be able to live long enough to see their granddaughter graduate from college. They don't necessarily want to control their blood sugars, right? So, but if you can link to them that the key to being able to walk to the mall is in cutting the salt out of your diet, and then you do all these other things about recognize their progress, give them little measurable, doable steps. All those are important. But if you start with helping them to do what they want and remind them when they have setbacks, the reason is because you want to do thus and so, then you have a much better chance of getting there.
And you ought to hear Uwe Reinhardt talk about how May Reinhardt recognizes his diet efforts or lack thereof. Yes, we have time for these last two questions from folks already standing at the mics.
Hi, my name is Anisha Darshi. I'm with the National Quality Forum, and most of you have been engaged with our work, so thank you for that. A question regarding some of the work that we've done over the past years around longitudinal measurement and really getting to patient preferences and balancing that with provider accountability and responsibility. One of the major measure gaps that we've come up with is that we actually don't have endorsed measures for patient self-management. We don't have a way to balance that with all the other process measures and outcome measures that we have. So I was wondering if there were any creative solutions to bring in measures around a patient's ability to do management of their chronic disease or chronic diseases to help get that implementation further in.
Good question.
There is a growing field called decision quality, in which you begin to look at what are the key, for each major clinical decision from the patient's perspective, what are the three or four questions they ought to be able to ask to qualify to participate in this decision? And the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision Making has been doing a lot of advanced work, and I think Mass General has done a lot of work in that. So I think that's one area that you might get some metrics out. And the other would be, you know, have you prescribed a decision? Can we raise the standard for informed consent to a degree where a patient really does need to be informed rather than just have a piece of paper? So,
Judy?
So the patient activation measure assesses people's ability to self-manage, and that would be a reasonable thing to do. And I really believe that we need to move to measurement that, like Don said, the decision quality or the ability, the self-management abilities, and think about that as an outcome of care instead of did they get the information or did they get the pamphlet, because that is not really accountability that I think we're looking for.
Hi, my name is Matthew Donnell. I'm a resident physician at Emory University School of Medicine, and I'm here on rotation on behalf of the American College of Preventive Medicine. My question goes out to the panel from my perspective as a resident physician, as well as from the different rotations I've had throughout my years, from a student progressing to an intern to a resident. And I'm very much for patient-centered care, specifically prescribing information to each patient based on their demographic background, socioeconomic demographics, their unique healthcare problems, as well as their health literacy, along with many other variables. But my question is, although the idea is great, every case I see individually every day comes in with their unique value system, and they try to look at the physician or their healthcare provider as the gatekeeper or source of that information. And one thing that I find is that we're very much pressed for time, and that we click on the electronic health record, or we write in the chart, and we consult this, we consult that, we consult this, we consult that. And what I wanted to ask for the panel, which I think one of the biggest challenges is, especially in prevention, is how are we going within the clinical setting to have a gatekeeper to provide that information prescription, because that information flow is already there to an extent. When I see a case that's diabetic per se, I do have an individual that consults out on education. There's a nutritionist that educates them on nutrition. I'm necessarily managing their diabetic medication. I refer them to public health resources where they can go get linked in to certain clinics. I contact a social worker if there is need for that. There is a nurse educator there at their side to teach them how to use their medicines. When you take that individual case by case basis, that's what I wanted to ask for the panel, providing that information prescription at the individual level. What is the solution there?
And that's the point I was trying to make with the info button standard discussion, that it is so difficult for a clinician to have time to do all of that unaided, that the more you can do to present it within the workflow, the better. But I also wanted to respond in this way, and this is not research that I know has happened yet, but I hope that it will. I think that we need to find metrics around the quality of patienthood, that we need to begin to measure and have at least non-financial accountability and reporting, visibility, transparency around the level of patienthood, the level of engagement that people have, to encourage them to do more. And I think that fits in with your question a little bit, but maybe the two things.
Yeah, actually, I would argue that I think what you described in many ways is exactly what you should be doing. Right? You know, you are that gatekeeper. You're that first point of contact. You can't do everything, obviously, as a resident, but, you know, when until you become an attending, that's another story. No, but, you know, clearly you're not going to have the time. You're going to have 7 minutes probably on average with your patient. So knowing that, you know, you'll have to be able to refer and to coordinate that care. And I believe that's the basis in many ways of this. We've been talking about this patient-centered medical home, knowing that each patient should have a primary care doctor that they go to and have that primary care doctor really be that person that coordinates and is able to refer out. I mean, obviously, it'd be great if the doctor could sit for half an hour and spend the kind of time, but if you need to have the patient referred to a nurse, referred to a pharmacist, referred to a diabetic educator. But I think in your role, knowing that you have all these resources that you yourself may not necessarily have the time to do, but knowing that you can do it, and I think, you know, that whole medical home concept of assigning patients to do that, you know, to go with a primary care doctor that can coordinate all that care, I think really is a major part of the solution.
I just want to add, what Don said about kind of the patienthood is important here, because people, we can give people information, but if they don't think they're up to the job, or if they don't think it's their job, it's not going to make any difference. So really understanding where the patient's coming from, and many times it's not information that they're lacking, it's that they're not confident. They feel overwhelmed by their situation. And so really understanding where the patient is coming from and meeting them there, I think is the key to helping people move forward.
That sounds like a pretty good place to stop. Although I would add, as a poor country lawyer with no background in advice, that you lose the term gatekeeper. It doesn't seem to resonate very well, whatever the value of the service. I had promised Don Kemper he could run a two-minute demonstration tape that's a reference to it, but I commend to you there is a website listed in his slides that you can sample a number of those demonstrations, and I think you'll find them quite useful. Let me ask you one last time, if you would, to fill out those blue evaluation forms before you leave. I want to thank you for being part of this discussion. I want to thank AARP for supporting and participating quite well in this briefing, and ask you to join me in thanking our panel for a terrific discussion.